Hi, my name is Matt. I'm the founder of Regeneration Projects, a small business that sees two great bays and a river as our most important business partners. We started at a kitchen table during Melbourne's epic COVID-19 lockdown, and now we're a B Corp and actor in the UN decade on ecosystem restoration. As we begin this episode, we'd like to acknowledge the two great bays, Port Phillip and Western Port, which are known to First Peoples as Nam and Wurrumbirrin, or Murrumbik. Without the bays and the Birrarung Yarra River, we wouldn't be in business today. So we show deep respect to First Nations elders, past and present, who for over 60,000 years have cared for the bays, Birrarung, and their catchment areas. Their ecological knowledge inspires us to practice business in partnership with nature. Now, choosing a career that tackles environmental issues like climate change, biodiversity loss, or pollution can be incredibly rewarding, but also super tough. When we listen to the stories of passionate and pioneering professionals, it stokes our inner fire and belief so that we can keep doing the work that we know needs to be done to benefit future generations. That's what the Two Bays podcast is all about. Stories of hope, grit, and determination, inspiring the planet's next generation of ecological leaders and entrepreneurs. This series is made in partnership with the Mornington Peninsula Shire Council and celebrates the stories of business and community champions at the forefront of local climate action. Let's tune in. Wamanjika, welcome and come with purpose to the Two Bays podcast. My name is Matt Sykes, and along with Claire Wilde, it's a pleasure to be joining you again for the episode. Again, spotlighting the leadership of climate active champions on the Mornington Peninsula. Before you begin, we'll take a moment to acknowledge those connections to country through elders past and present, especially to the Boonwurrung and the Bunurong community. So there, where we'll be talking about the connections between climate action and land care today. So that stewardship, that custodianship, particularly of waterways, will be a theme today. So really a shout out to, that continuing connection of culture, First Nations culture on the Mornington Peninsula, and that importance of passing on knowledge to future generations. Today, we're in for a treat. We're joined by Chantelle Morton, who is the land care facilitator for the Mornington Peninsula Shire Council, and also Greg Holland, who's the owner of Karunya, a farm on the peninsula. He's also the president of the Mornington Peninsula Landcare Network and a committee member of Main Creek Catchment Landcare Group. Chantelle, Greg, thank you so much for joining us. We've got lots to explore together today. Chantelle, I'm going to come to you first. Just curious to hear, just in a brief way, what's so important about, you know, having these conversations about climate action on the Mornington Peninsula, in particular the role of landholders and farmers like Greg?
Hi, Matt. I'm excited to be here today, so thanks for having me along. So this conversation is really important because one, we need to raise awareness of the land care movement and really get people, that wouldn't otherwise be involved in land care involved, and just to, you know, get to know what sort of projects we're embarking on. The more people involved, the better.
Absolutely. And Greg, how do you see that connection of climate action, climate leadership on the Mornington Peninsula?
Thanks very much also for having me on, Matt. It's always a pleasure. I actually see very little difference between what land care does as its core activity, which is revegetation and such, and our efforts to reduce climate change. If you look at the climate change for the world, we've just passed 1.5 degrees and we're heading towards 2 degrees, and there's not too much evidence, including in Australia, I hate to say, of us actually doing enough to be able to get out of that. So we actually have to adapt as well as hopefully eventually stop it. So I'm going to address the adaption component. The adaption component is, firstly, you have to actually change. We're going to have to change our lifestyles. There will be more extreme weather, and there'll be more occasions of extreme weather. That includes heat waves, strong winds, heavy rain. You've seen it all in the last few years, and that's what you're going to get. So that's one thing. But let's say we're actually living on the peninsula. We can do a few other things as well. We can actually, to some extent, stop climate change occurring as much on the peninsula. And I've said this to many people, if you just go ahead with the revegetation that we've already done and we're planning over the next 5 or 6, maybe even 10 years, that revegetation has the potential to drop the temperature on the peninsula from 1.5 degrees increase to about a half a degree increase. Having the oceans around the edge don't do any harm, and they help you get that 1 degree. So basically, every time someone puts in a tree, they're doing the same thing as if they buy an electric car. They're actually doing something really locally to try and remove that problem.
Thanks so much for sharing those reflections and thoughts, Greg. I might stick with you and ask you another question about the land care movement more broadly. I'd love to hear your reflections on, firstly, how you came to work in this area, and secondly, how you've seen the movement evolve over the years.
How did I come to work in this area? It's a long story, but to make it short, when I retired, I bought this little place down here on the peninsula for several reasons. I grew up on a farm and I wanted to go back to a farm, but having grown up on a farm, I knew how much work was involved and I wasn't going to be doing it in my retirement. So I bought something that I could actually revegetate. And the goal at that point was to become carbon neutral, indeed carbon negative, so that I could actually get out some of the gases that I put in my life and things like that. And it just so happened that I got a visit from a couple of people from Landcare saying that they were looking at putting in biolinks. This is 12 or 13 years ago now. And would I be prepared to have some new vegetation on my property? And there's me thinking, it's going to cost all this money to do vegetation. They said, we'll do it for nothing. The answer was about as quick a yes as I've ever given in my life. And sort of one thing led to another. I got really interested in land care. I joined up with the local group, the Main Creek group, and then eventually moved into doing more for the Mornington Peninsula Land Care Network. And as you just heard, I'm now the president. I think it was because I didn't walk backwards fast enough, actually.
Greg, I love to hear that. That's a really cool story. A couple of words that you use there that I'd love to hear a little bit more about, mainly because I would be curious to hear how you define them. And also, I'm wondering if our listeners might be too. Two words are carbon negative, well, that was one phrase, two words in one phrase. And the other one was biolinks. Can you explain what those mean to us?
Yep, sorry about the jargon. Carbon negative is exactly as it reads. If you are driving your car down the street, you're putting carbon dioxide and plus a few other things into the air, and that means you're carbon positive. You're actually increasing the amount of carbon dioxide in the air. If you're growing a tree, you're actually taking carbon dioxide out of the air, so you're actually carbon negative. And there's other ways of getting rid of the carbon out of the air, of course, but that's the way that we're doing it. The other one was biolink. And this one's actually a beautiful concept. If you look at a map, or let's say a satellite picture is even better, of the peninsula, you'll see all these little patches of bush with lots of bare paddocks in between them. You'll see a couple of big paddocks of bush. There is the Arthur Seton State Park, and then there is the Mornington Peninsula National Park, the northern part of which is called Greens Bush. So what a biolink does is it says, well, if those animals are stuck in that patch of bush, what happens if it burns down? Even if it doesn't burn down, what happens to their genes? We know that as things get more and more, or fewer and fewer, they start to have all sorts of genetic deformities and things like that. So basically, a biolink is a road that allows animals and to some extent genes to actually pass between those areas of bush. I like to use an example when I'm talking to school kids. Say, and I'm a boy, right? So say I've got a girlfriend on the other side of the peninsula and I live in Rosebud and I want to go visit her. what would I do? I'd get in a car and drive over there. But what would you do if there was no road? It would be a very long hike and it would be a dangerous hike. So that's what we're doing to animals when we actually put all these bear paddocks in and we're going through those and just giving them a little roadway of their own that they can actually utilize.
I love to hear those definitions, Greg, not only because they help me learn and enhance my knowledge a little bit, but also because they tie into this theme that keeps coming up. And I think we're seeing come up time and time again in the regeneration and sustainability world generally, which is the idea that you can't address the climate crisis, the biodiversity crisis in isolation, that they're really interlinked. I think all of those definitions and those explanations that you gave around what carbon negative means, what biolinks are, really show how addressing climate change goes hand in hand with supporting biodiversity outcomes and likewise creating those biolinks or sort of ways of, I think your words, Greg, were sort of protecting genes is a really important way of not only preserving nature or, you know, the sort of flora side of things, but also protecting fauna, so the animals that depend on them as well. Chantel, I might hand to you now. Greg has shared some really awesome insights around his experience and what it's been like as someone at council. I'd be really curious to hear your perspective on how the land care movement has evolved from your perspective and perhaps how your role came to be and how you ended up working there.
Thanks, Claire. I actually started with my journey with land care probably in 2017, 2018, and I was actually the project coordinator for the Greensbush to Arthur's Seat biolink that Greg mentioned. From that, I then was invited to basically be the land care facilitator. I was taking over from Jackie Salter. And I inherited not only the Greensbush to Arthur's Seat biolink, but also a map. This crazy map, but beautiful map of biolinks or potential biolinks across the whole peninsula. And apart from my role in helping all the land care groups, I'm also charged with seeing this vision roll out. So the map is very much like Greg described it. It's like a spidery network of vegetation that is left on the peninsula. A lot of it goes along waterways, and so we basically we have had to implement the Linking the Mornington Peninsula Landscape project. So it started off with lots of little biolinks, and now we are gradually looking at joining all of those together. So it's really fabulous. Yeah.
I love that description that you gave, Chantel, of sort of almost growing that network of biolinks and also your descriptions of the positive impact that creates. One thing I'm keen to understand a little bit more about is how you explain this to your different stakeholders, whether that's a member of the public, whether that's other people at council, whether that's organizations that you're working with. The reason I'm really curious to hear this is because often when we speak about the importance of protecting nature and biodiversity, it can feel very ambiguous to some people. In particular, say I'm the owner of a business and I'm trying to understand how my business interacts with nature or what the relationship is there. It can feel really disconnected. The way you've just described all of this work around biolinks has sparked a lot of thoughts in my head, and I'd love to hear from your perspective how you can communicate that really well to other members of your community.
So communicating it can be a little bit challenging, but it's pretty simple. And so we go out and we door knock and we basically engage one-on-one with landholders. And Basically, Greg has been a fantastic asset to the Landcare network because he has been able to develop the Biolink thought process. So it's been easy to engage landholders that have come to the peninsula for tree change, but then a little bit harder to engage the people who have got parcels of land and their land use is very dedicated, that, you know, they might have a market garden, they might have a farm. So they have been a little bit more challenging to engage. Greg has developed a management plan, a land management plan, a whole farm approach to revegetation, and it looks at planting for a whole farm approach to planting for not only biodiversity, but productivity and climate change. And the productivity is the key. So if you can convince the masses, you know, that the business holders, that this will actually improve productivity, well, then you've won the battle.
Yeah, Greg, that reminds me of, firstly, thank you so much for that explanation, Chantal. And I think that reminds me of your comment before, Greg, when you were looking at setting this all up and you asked how much it would cost and you were told nothing and you sort of thought, oh, that must be a no-brainer. Greg, I might hand over to you now. I'd be really curious to hear from your experience what a whole farm approach to revegetation is and how you kind of, how that idea evolved for you.
Yes, of course, when I said at no cost, that was no cost to me. That was because some good land care person went out and got a bunch of contract grant money to be able to do it. The sad story is that I then had to come around to the worm always turns, and I'm now the poor bugger going out and trying to get the land grant information, and money and such. The whole of farm plan, and I guess Chantal is being too modest here, because the initial idea actually came from her on a grant that she had with Melbourne Water. And the whole of farm plan does three things. Firstly, it actually is an expert sits down with the farmer or with the landholder. It's not all of them are actual farmers, so I'll just call it a landholder for that reason, and just finds out what they would like to do on their farm. And then it looks at all of the things that are important to a farm. You know, what soils do they have? It's amazing how few people are not really sure even about that. What is the climate like? You know, what is the rainfall? How many sheep can you carry? How many cattle can you carry? How do you move cattle and sheep around and all that sort of thing? So that's not me. That's another expert. And then I actually have the component of describing how the productivity works in all of this. And the numbers here are really quite simple. There is an enormous amount of scientific publications now which show that if you take a property with nothing but bare paddocks, almost regardless of where you are, but let's say it's in roughly our area, then if you put in 30% of your property with vegetation and do it properly, your productivity at the end of that will be substantially higher than you had with just the paddocks. So you've taken away all that grass, but then you're actually doing better. The optimal is around about 20%, to give you an idea. But once you've put in the vegetation helps the rain that's falling come down into the ground a lot easier. It's now in the ground, and then it just gradually moves sideways out into your paddocks. The vegetation protects your paddocks from winds, both cold winds and for hot drying winds. Let's think of the hot drying winds. You end up with a lot less evaporation on your paddock, so you actually end up with a lot less loss of that moisture. And then with the cold winds, if you just started doing lambs and there's a really cold wind burst come through, the Bureau of Meteorology even puts out lamb forecasts for severe weather because of that. You're going to lose possibly even all your lambs. All of those things die down a little bit and get better. And the bottom line in all of this is the grass actually grows faster. So that's what we're talking about by the improvement in in farm management and productivity. The final thing here is as Chantal said, we go out and we door knock and such. When I first got involved, I would say about one in three would sort of close the door. About another one in three would say, you know, I really want to help the in nature, but I don't want to lose any money. Well, it's actually turned around from that. We still do door knock, but in the last year in particular, we've actually had more people approach us and say, can we join, than the other way around. What has really happened is that the Bush Telegraph has got out there and others are passing the information around and people are saying, oh, that's not a bad idea. I wonder how I can get in on that.
Yeah, brilliant. It's great to hear that shift. And I guess that's a great example of the behaviour change process, isn't it? Something that feels strange and unknown at first can go through a process becoming, the only logical thing or the most logical thing to do, which is brilliant. Greg, I would love to just drill down to a specific scenario. Is there a patch on your property, on Karanya, or another local property that gives us like a scenario of how that holistic approach and working with land care revegetation has led to a specific outcome and benefits for a specific landholder?
Okay, so you do have to realize that when you put a tree in, it takes about 10 to 15 years before the benefit really kicks in, but the benefit is there from a very early stage, obviously. So let's just take a bare paddock. It belongs to old MacDonald. And basically, that bare paddock, we're now going to do some revegetation on. So the first thing you consider is all the way around the boundary, in other words, along the fence lines, you put in shelter belts. They're lines of bush, not just gum trees. It's all the way down to in the scale, all the way down to the grasses and things like that, that is actually designed to stop or protect from the wind flow. So we go all the way around. Therefore, it doesn't matter which direction the wind's coming from, we're in business. The next thing is that you actually, in one of the corners or somewhere on the property, often it's the best place to do it is where there's actually a river or a creek and things like that, you put in a bush patch. That bush patch is home to an awful lot of species. And everyone, when you say species, immediately thinks, oh, that'll be possums and kangaroos and things like that. The species that are really in bulk in there are insects and bats and birds. And all those insects and bats and birds go out into your paddock every day and gobble up the nasties that are out there taking away your grass. So you've got that little protection. The next thing you do is you put in a few scattered big bush trees. You've all driven around the countryside somewhere and you'll see all these trees scattered across the countryside. They are remarkable biodiversity in their own right. They act as a little local focuser of the water and everything else. And they also provide shade for your stock and such. So basically, that's how it goes about. Coming back to my place, you wonder, well, how many species could there be? Well, I've only got 16 acres or 8 hectares in the modern terminology. And I actually have 1,036 native species on my property, of which all bar about 20 of them are actually beneficial to the farm. The 20 that aren't beneficial are basically taking a real hidey from all the good guys.
Yeah, and just to kind of give a sense, when you first came to the property, were you able to do an audit and get some guide about that transition and improvement that you've been part of, bearing in mind that these things do take time?
Yes, I had. The trouble is, to do a proper audit, you've got to be there for several years and you've got to go through all the seasons and you've got to go through droughts and everything else. So bearing that in mind, the one area I can talk with confidence about is that I had an area which had a farm dam. It was about a 9 acres, taken about in totality, area, which was an old creek that had got filled in, and it was basically useless, to be quite honest, except for the farm dam. So what I did was I actually put in some cleaning up. I put in new little ponds and things like that and just let it sit. Okay, well, that now has 124 species in it. of which 86 came back by themselves. There were none of the 86 there to start with, I guarantee that. And of the remaining 40-odd, what I actually recorded was only 9 or 10. So let's say it's even 20. You've added 100 species have come in because of that one little act.
Yeah, brilliant. And that's really interesting because like similar to what Claire was saying before, we hear people talking about nature positive outcomes and so on. But like that little patch on your property gives us a clear example of when you shift, you know, management practices and you create the right conditions, you can see that uplift in the diversity and the abundance of and also the connectivity of wildlife. It's brilliant. Chantel, coming back to you, you must have seen some interesting, you know, transformations and stories, people that were so hard against, you know, giving up that land and making those so-called sacrifices for wildlife, but then only to come around later and to say, gee, I wish I kind of did this earlier. Is there a story or is there an example of someone, without naming names, but of someone or a property where, you know, there's just... Yeah, it was just a beautiful thing to watch and be part of.
Oh gosh, where do I begin? How can I isolate just one person? Yes, in a nutshell. But I'm just trying to think. So I have seen so many different properties become involved that were, you know, potentially hesitant beforehand. There have been market gardens, there have been farms, there have been, tree changes. They all have been absolutely, just really grateful at the end of it. I remember I once, I personally planted a couple of paddocks in COVID times. So when I was the project manager for Greensbush Atharseat Biolink, and me and the landholder just got out in the paddock, and it was when we were only allowed to be two people outside at any given time, and we basically planted 2,000 trees, shrubs and understory, and the transformation of the two areas that we had planted was just phenomenal. Going back a year later, I remember I was invited a year later to come back and revisit the site, and the transformation of the wetland area that we had planted was phenomenal. It was mind-blowing. And I think, you know, the land care is such a great community, and it is really it's lovely to see all the different people joining that community. So not only do people get, you know, potentially project money and, you know, whatnot, but they're able to have the community come together on their property if they so wish, and it's just really lovely to see.
Thank you so much for sharing that example, Chantel. I think that concept of community is something incredibly important. And I know that in this conversation, when we first started talking about productivity, I think sometimes when we're speaking about regeneration, the idea of productivity can be a little bit something that you're not necessarily aiming for. And sometimes it can feel a little bit contradictory to what regeneration is all about. And I think that example that you just gave around building community, and you think, well, maybe that redefines productivity in a slightly different way, where it's not just about creating more widgets or more things or selling more stuff. Maybe it's about creating better outcomes for people and also our natural environment or Mother Earth as well. So very, very cool to hear those examples. Conscious, we just have a few minutes left. And before we wrap up, I'd love to ask both of you to reflect on the careers that you've had and even your broader relationship with the land care movement as time has gone on. And maybe if you could take yourself back, whether that's 1 year, whether that's 10 years, and give your past self some advice earlier on in your career about just how to make more of an impact, or you know, maybe how to get where you are today. I'd love to hear what that advice would be. Maybe Chantal, I'll hand to you first.
Thanks, Claire. Well, I started my career fairly late in life. I started it to basically address a concern that I had about what sort of a planet we were leaving our children. And I've got four young children, or they were young at the time when I started thinking about this. I would say nothing you can do is too small. The collective land care movement is, collectively we can achieve so much while all individually doing our little bit. So I would say that I would probably, in reflection, look at there is actually a lot of hope for the future. And I'm thinking, like, just seeing the evolution of the Linking the Mornington Peninsula Landscape Project, you know, it started with a vision, and then it then went into implementing small biolinks in each of the catchments. Now we're looking at joining those. It's really quite exciting and extremely hopeful. And I didn't necessarily have that hope when I started out. So, it's been a wild ride and I'm loving it.
And how, even though you said that, you know, it's all about starting small, it's also pretty amazing to hear you say that and also hear you talk about the impact that you've created through all of this work. And I think that doesn't sound small to me. That sounds
it's
pretty incredible.
It's grown big.
Yeah. Greg, I'd love to hear any final reflections that you have, advice your past self, or even perhaps people who are just taking their first steps in the climate movement.
Well, first I have to say that I'm a fraction older than Chantal, I think about three times, especially when I try and get out of bed in the morning, the bones ache. But this is actually my fourth career. And I started off in a career that I was born into, that was dancing, and then I became a scientist. And then I actually formed a small company that made unmanned aircraft, actually the first one in the world, first civilian one in the world. And then when I retired, I came back to farming, and that's when I moved into land care and such. And what I can say without qualification, well, except for the first one, because I was born into it, but without qualification, look at it. If you like it, give it a try, but give it a try small, because there's no real loss if you lose out. And a lot of people actually start off in something and say, oh, this is not quite I thought it would be, and move out. There's nothing wrong with that. The second thing is make contact and don't be afraid to ask questions. Make contact with, if you find a smart person, chat to them. If you find a dumb person, chat to them. But the thing is, make contact, and then you sort of start to learn the way of doing things, and then just volunteer. Even if you're being paid, volunteer to help somewhere and do that and be keen, and you'd be surprised where you'll end up. I won't be surprised you'll end up where you'll end up, but you will be.
Awesome, Greg. Thank you both for sharing your knowledge and your experiences today. One of the reflections that was coming through during this conversation was Regeneration Projects is literally in dialogue each day with people in local business, in government, in universities, nonprofit organizations, First Nations groups. And more we're starting this conversation around that intersection between climate and biodiversity. And there was one conversation yesterday where it was an inner city organization, huge cultural influence, huge staff, and also, let's say, customer reach. And they were asking this question about some of the global biodiversity framework, the task force on nature-related disclosures, and what they can do. And they started talking about biodiversity offsets. And I'm not going to open up that Pandora's box because we won't have time for it. But one of the things in responding to that I mentioned was that if they started to imagine their particular urban business as having context and relationship with the Burra, the Yarra River, and started to play a custodianship role where they were taking care of all of the water that was falling on their property, perhaps even water that was passing through from other places. And that they could say hand on heart that everything that is in and around that property was exiting cleaner than what it left, that there was more biodiversity there, that could create a chain of reaction to other properties and streetscapes, that by the time a drop of water falls on their property and eventually hits the Birrarung, that it could continue to be so clean and continue to support the pulse of that ecosystem. What ripple effects could that create for our broader community, not just from a wildlife and an ecology perspective, but also for the quality of life of people walking those streets, experiencing, looking out those views of their office, spending that time during the lunch break, depending upon some of these spaces to run their businesses. And I think that sense of custodianship, when you paint the pictures of those tapestries of wildlife corridors and those networks, and I go back to my landscape architecture days, I can see all of that happening in an urban context, but perhaps those people that are in business or an organization really not thinking that they are like a farmer, a landholder, a custodian in the same way. We just have to take away all the concrete and all of those materials to be able to get to that point. So thank you for transforming our perspectives and opening us into that world, Chantal and Greg, because it does help us connect a little bit more deeply to country and think about our role here on the planet, not just for ourselves, but as you say, future generations. Folks, we're going to wrap up there. This has been the Two Bays Quadcast with Claire and Matt. Thank you very much to Chantal and Greg for your work, both through the Mornington Peninsula Shire Council and that land care facilitator role, Chantal, and Greg in the number of hats that you wear in making that choice in your fourth career to take on Karunya. And also as the president of the Mornington Peninsula Landcare Network and also the committee member of Man Creek Catchment Landcare Group. All the best, folks. Until next episode. Cheers.
How amazing are those Mornington Peninsula climate champions? Must be something in the water. Against the odds, they're transforming climate anxiety into climate action. Keep your eyes out for new episodes coming soon. So you're feeling inspired and ready to act. What can you do next? Firstly, subscribe to the Two Bays podcast on your favorite channel. Then visit the Regeneration Project's website for more info about our ecological leadership and strategic consultancy work. Lastly, don't forget to follow Regeneration Projects on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn, as well as subscribe to our seasonal newsletter. My name is Matt, and on behalf of Regeneration Projects and the Two Bays, thank you for tuning in and see you on the next episode of Two Bays, a Business and a Kitchen Table podcast.